This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, but you already knew that. This is the Takeout Podcast. I am joined, as I am every week, by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris, political director of CBS News. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
Big day here at the Takeout Podcast because after many, many endeavors, after many emails, phone calls, pleadings, and all sorts of other statutory and non-statutory begging, we have our first member of the Trump administration cabinet at our table, Mick Mulvaney.
Well, you asked the wrong people first.
We certainly did.
I was promised.
Director of the Office of Management and Budget. And we are at the Tombs Restaurant in Georgetown. The reason we're at the Tombs Restaurant in Georgetown is because Mick Mulvaney, when he was enjoying part of his misspent youth, was at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service, and he was an exemplary student in economics and other matters, became president of his class, probably launching his campaign in and around the very table we're sitting at in the Tombs Restaurant. Mick Mulvaney, thanks for joining us at the Takeout.
Thank you very much. Actually, that's not right.
Okay.
I was not president of the class here. That goes all the way back to high school. So as my boss would say, that is fake news.
Why isn't it in every one of your bios?
It's just wrong. Somebody printed it like that. I was president of the class in high school.
Okay.
But what about, were you an exemplary student here at Georgetown?
You were an exemplary student.
I did okay. They let me out, which was nice.
Come on. You got a big scholarship and all
I
that
did. I
get,
cool
yeah.
no, stuff. I did okay. Which So if my kids are watching, study hard.
That's right. And your children, you have triplets. Give us their names, because I'm intrigued by all three names.
Caroline, who is a freshman at a nearby university, may be making an appearance here shortly.
Right here, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Figure that one out.
She doesn't tell people what her dad does for a living, and I understand that.
Most children don't.
Yeah, I don't feel bad
Mine
about
included.
That. And then Finnegan and James are seniors in high school. Caroline skipped a year to get away from her brothers.
Are those literary-inspired names?
Finnegan is actually it's a good Irish name. I wanted Finbar because it's a good traditional Irish name, and my wife settled on Finnegan, which was great. James is a family name on both sides.
Excellent. All right, let's talk about something. There's an upstart program on CBS. It's just launching. It's got a lot of ambition, big hopes and dreams, something called 60 Minutes.
You may have heard of it.
I think it's got a future. This last episode of 60 Minutes, there was a guy on there you might have heard of, Steve Bannon. He sat down with another guy you might have heard of, Charlie Rose. We all certainly know who Charlie Rose is. Steve Bannon said something I'd like you to react to. So, Katyan, if you'd be so kind, soundbite number one.
The Republican establishment is trying to nullify the 2016 election. That's a brutal fact we have to face.
The Republican establishment.
The Republican establishment.
Wants to nullify the 2016 election.
Trying to nullify the 2016 election. Right. Absolutely.
Who?
I think Mitch McConnell and to a degree Paul Ryan. They do not want Donald Trump's populist, economic, nationalist agenda to be implemented. It's very obvious.
Agree or disagree?
I don't know. It's an interesting way to put it. I think I draw some of the same conclusions that Bannon does, that clearly we've had a difficult time getting a lot of our agenda, any of our agenda passed. Whether or not that means they're out to get us or they're just not capable of delivering could be sort of subject to interpretation.
How do you interpret it?
I think right now the House and the Senate have been anti-Obama for so long. I got here in 2011, and I think we learned really well how to sort of be against the administration of Barack Obama. And I don't think the House and the Senate have made a very good transition to actually being in charge and running the country. They're still playing defense when they should be playing offense, and the folks who suffer are the folks who want to see Donald Trump's agenda put in place.
But that's not what they promised in the 2016 campaign. They promised the 2016 campaign, we're going to know what to do. We're going to be the adults. We're going to be the grown-up party with all three.
Yep. And we're going to repeal Obamacare.
Yep. The House and the Senate, and what do they got to show for it?
Listen, I got asked the other day, they said, is the president annoyed with the Republicans in the House and the Senate? And the answer is, yeah, he absolutely is. But then again, most Republican voters are, and many independent voters are. The folks who gave the Republicans the House and the Senate want to see more action out of the House and the Senate than we've seen so far, and I think they're just as angry as the president is.
So who's at fault here? Is it the president? Is it McConnell and Ryan? Is it a combination of both?
You know, and I don't want to sit here and say, well, this person's at fault, that person's at fault, but certainly I have been frustrated, as the president has been, with our lack of ability to deliver legislatively on the Hill. And we all know who's in charge of the Hill. The House actually has actually passed some good stuff. They passed the health care bill replacement, for example. The Senate did not. The House has actually done a lot of good things. They passed a bunch of spending bills already. The appropriations bills are taking up an omnibus again this week. So the House is actually working pretty hard. And the Senate is where legislation goes to die. And sooner or later, listen, if I have one complaint of...
Wait a minute. The Senate is where Trump administration legislation goes to die?
It's where all legislation goes to die. And that's... it's
remember, spoken this like is, a pure House member.
That's exactly right. This is the deliberative body. And I think if I have one criticism of Mitch McConnell... And I'm not overly critical of him. I don't think...
Well, go ahead. Be overly critical.
He's pushed back hard enough against the obstruction when it comes to the nominations. And I think one of the reasons you're not seeing more substance taken up on the floor of the Senate, this is really boring and down in the weeds, but that's what you get to do in these shows, right?
We do.
Is that every single time we have a nomination come up, the Senate Democrats filibuster. And they use that time on the floor to prevent substance from coming to the floor. There was no reason. I was the latest confirmed OMB director in history. I've got folks who have had their hearings 8, 10, 12 weeks ago who don't even have a date set yet for their confirmation on the floor because the Democrats in the Senate are using that to obstruct any substantive legislation. And if I could get Mitch McConnell to do one thing other than change the 60-vote rule, which I would get him to push back hard and get the Democrats to clear the deck so we can actually talk about substance and not allow them to use these nominations to hold up things.
On this most exceptional podcast, we had a guest last week. You may also have heard of Ronna McDaniel, chairwoman of the Republican National Committee. She talked about her anxieties similar to yours and those expressed by grassroots voters. Katiana, number two.
I channel the middle of the country where I come from. They're looking at Washington saying, give us some solutions. I don't care how you do it. Let's be pragmatic. If you have to work across party lines, if it's in the best interest of the American people, get it done. And that's what the president's bringing. And so he's going to work with Republicans. He's going to work with Democrats. That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. Was it a good thing for the president to cut the deal he did with Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader of the House, and Chuck Schumer, the minority leader of the Senate, over a 3-month extension and continuing resolution to avoid a government shutdown and marry that to Hurricane Harvey and Irma relief, even though you were kind of cut out of that process?
I was in that process. I was in the room. Absolutely.
Yes, but that was not what you went in the room thinking was going to happen, no, or Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan was going to do.
That's fair. That was not the outcome that I expected from that meeting. That is a completely fair and accurate statement. To your question, I think it was an absolute and unadulterated success. And in fact, the more I think about it now, the more I think about all the good things that will come from that for this administration. So what if we go down in order? Now we get to focus on taxes, right, which has been a priority for the president from day one. And we get a chance to clear the decks to talk about that. We get to prove that we can govern. I mean, face it, if you go back and you read the press coming out of the August recess, it was all, oh, the world is going to end in September because we have the debt ceiling and the CR and Donald Trump doesn't know how to govern. And he proves that he knows how to govern. We also decouple the debt ceiling from the fight on the omnibus spending bill at the end of the year, because while it's technically a 3-month extension to the debt ceiling, using extraordinary measures, Secretary Mnuchin should be able to take that to at least February. So now we will not have a debt ceiling hanging over us as we're talking about funding the government at the end of the year. I could go on and on and on. There's actually a chance now to raise the debt ceiling using reconciliation in a 2018 budget and only pass it with 50 votes in the Senate versus we had to have 60 votes last week. So I could go down the list. And there's 5 or 6 things I love about the deal, and I'm very, very pleased with it. I'm glad it passed.
There's a lot of terminology you mentioned there. You dropped a lot of buzzwords.
Sorry
about
that.
No, no, it's okay. We do this on the show. We hear the buzzwords, and we pick them apart. But before we do that, we're going to order lunch. And as our esteemed guest, Mr. Director, what would you like to have for lunch at one of your absolute favorite restaurants?
Oh, no, it is. I'm having the BLT, please. So the hamburger here is fantastic and a great lunch, but it's a little heavy for sitting here and doing an interview at the same time.
And French fries are okay now?
Absolutely.
Juicy Lucy for me, Sarah, with French fries.
What is that?
It's a big cheeseburger with jalapeno cheese stuffed inside, salsa, bacon, and lots of other stuff. There you go.
And for you?
Fish and chips.
Fish and
Fish and chips. Yes.
Do we, all right. Should we ask about the etymology of the word Juicy Lucy and how it got the name or anything?
Mr. Director, we're just going to skip right over that.
Just,
okay.
I mean, I got the hamburger. I'm not sure why you have to have a name for your food.
Wait, that's why I just read from the menu.
I got
okay,
you.
I just read from the menu. I'm not...
Sure you did, man.
I'm not freelancing on that one, okay? Now, you said a couple things.
Yeah.
What we'd like to do for our audience all the time is there's lots of words that we kick around in Washington that we know what they mean, but our audience may not. Omnibus. You just said omnibus. Yeah. What does that mean?
Well, the government needs to be funded every single year, and there's a couple different ways to do that. The way we're supposed to do it is by passing appropriations bills, as many as 12 of them.
A spending bill, right.
A spending bill, that's exactly right. When we don't do that, then there's two ways then to fund the government, which is to do a continuing resolution, which is essentially say, look, we'll take last year's spending bill and we'll extend it this year. Whatever it said last year, we'll do this year. And that's where we're operating right now, up until December. And the third piece is you could do what's called an omnibus bill.
Where you stitch together some of those spending bills.
All those 12 bills. Like
two or year, four, yeah, or six eight, or eight, whatever.
Sometimes we did a cromnibus, which is a CR plus an omnibus. All sorts of great words. The bottom line is that the government is funded through the end of December, early December, actually, and we will need to have some sort of bill that passes in December to fund the government beyond December 8th. And that is going to be the next sort of big spending discussion that we have in Washington.
And how much are you involved in that? It seems like it's something that Congress is really involved with. It reminds me of when the former Patriots head coach quit the Patriots and said, I'd like to be able to buy the groceries if I'm going to cook the dinner. You're not really cooking the dinner here. This is sort of...
I'm actually pretty heavily involved. I think if you really? Look at the Division of Labor, it would be Secretary Mnuchin takes lead on the debt ceiling, sort of supported by myself, Mr. Cohn. Cohn and Mnuchin are leading.
Gary Cohn, Chief Economic Advisor to the President in the White House.
Correct. And Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary. They are sort of co-leading on taxes, and I'm supporting them on that because it's also tied to budget. And then I'll take the lead on the spending bills.
One last thing before we go to our first break. If you were still a member of the House, you probably would have voted against this idea of just a three-month extension of the debt limit and marrying it also to disaster relief, because when those opportunities came up in the House, you did exactly that. You voted against it and said we can't have spending on disaster relief that's not offset and marry it to a debt ceiling increase because we're not accomplishing anything. How comfortable are you with this reality now that you're wearing a different hat?
Really comfortable. I'll tell you the same thing that I told my, because I got that question.
You got ripped on that last week.
Actually, that's not true, by the way. I know a bunch of folks.
Gentle ribbing.
Tell us what happened.
It was CNN called us up, and I'm sorry to mention another network, but they called up.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly. Another network called up and said, look, we're going to print that you got booed out of the meeting. And I'm like, I got booed at the meeting, but everybody gets booed at the meeting. It's like going to a fraternity house meeting. I mean, I've thrown food at people in that meeting. It's not exactly sedate. So it was a very well-mannered meeting. It was fun. There was a lot of ribbing. Believe me, having me go in and ask for a debt ceiling, there's a lot of folks who've waited for that a long time.
You could have just said Mnuchin got booed.
Yeah. I let Mnuchin speak for himself. I mean, look, I was in the Senate the day before, and they were joking that they had to sell tickets because people wanted to pay to see
pay-per-view.
Me raise. That's exactly right. So, listen,
you were eating some of your past words and positions, right?
So I'll tell you the same thing I told them after they tried to get their pound of flesh out of me. Look, when I was in the House, one of the things I was against was long-term debt ceiling increases. And a short term is something I had asked for many, many times before because it gave us another chance to have the discussion. If you have an 18-month increase, you don't have a chance to have any more discussion about it for a long time. And now the conservatives have a chance between now and Christmas to make their case. Plus, as I mentioned earlier when I was dropping all that inside baseball language, to raise the debt ceiling in 2017, so now, would take 60 votes in the Senate. But if they do a reconciliation instructions in the budget, which is a technical part
of
the budget.
We'll get to that in a minute.
They can raise the debt ceiling in December with 50 votes, which means you don't have to cut a deal with the Democrats, which is a much better deal for the conservatives in the House. So there's a bunch of reasons to vote for it.
Got it. As we go to break, just remember that scene in Animal House where John Belushi stands up and screams, "Food fight." That's what Mick Mulvaney apparently did more than once at a House Republican conference meeting, if I read you correctly. Anyway, we'll get into that and food fighting and more details on what kind of food Mick Mulvaney threw when he was a House Republican when you come back and join us at the Takeout. We're at the Tombs Restaurant in Georgetown. Mick Mulvaney, Director, Office of Management and Budget, is our very special guest.
You're listening to The Takeout
So last week in the cabinet room in the White House, there was some cub reporter, might have been a child or something. It might have been bring your kid to work day or something. I don't know. He found his way into the cabinet room and he asked the president a question about the debt ceiling and possible political solutions to that. Let's listen to that question and then the president's answer.
Do you want to get rid of that vote process entirely, Mr. President?
Well, I think that, you know, it could be discussed. For many years, people have been talking about getting rid of debt ceiling altogether. And there are a lot of good reasons to do that. So certainly that's something that will be discussed. We even discussed it at the meeting that we had yesterday. It complicates things. It's really not necessary because you're talking about budget. So it's really not necessary. But it's certainly something we could discuss. But as long as it's there, it will never be violated.
Okay, I was making fun of myself. That was me asking the question.
I didn't recognize the voice.
And here's just a little bit of background lore for those of you who are absolutely fascinated by the debt ceiling.
They still let you in the room?
Yes.
That was the last time, actually.
Almost every day. Congress has raised or suspended the debt ceiling 79 times since the year 1960. And every president since Harry S. Truman has signed into law at least one such bill. I asked the president because it became clear after the conversations with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and others that the president was open to this idea, which had been kicked around before, but I don't think any president has so publicly embraced it, OMB Director Mick Mulvaney, of getting rid of the process of voting to increase the debt ceiling, which is the vote that Congress must take to say, yes, we are increasing our debt amount to pay for things we've already decided to pay for. Are you in favor, conceptually, politically, mathematically, of getting rid of that process and having no debt ceiling vote bedevil any future American president, this one or successors or any future Congress?
Keep in mind, I think that there have been various processes in the past for raising the debt ceiling. There used to be in major, I don't know if you were
the
around,
Gephardt Rule.
Gephardt Rule. And, of course, what that means is that when you vote for a budget.
A budget resolution.
You are
right.
They deem an increase to the debt ceiling to match the budget, which sounds fine until you recognize where we are in the politics today. What would be the first outcome of that in this environment would be you'd never pass a budget.
You'd never pass a budget,
exactly,
right.
And then you lose the
tool.
Which
is more or less what has gone on.
Well, no, we passed a budget in 2017. We're getting ready to pass a budget for 2018. But again, the budget becomes that tool of reconciliation,
right,
to get around that 60 votes in the Senate. So again, you're getting way down in the weeds, but all of these things are sort of woven together. The budget, the debt ceiling,
right,
reconciliation.
But I mean, this is something. I asked the president a specific question,
yes,
about a process legislatively, not with the Gephardt Rule or some sort of other mechanism that kind of implies where you state as a policy of the federal government of the United States, like most countries in the industrialized first world economy, we don't even worry about this.
He's asked me to look at it. In fact, he instructed me at the meeting with Mrs. Pelosi and Mr. Schumer and the rest of the Republican leaders that to take a look at it. And we're going to do that and we're going to brief him on it. I don't know.
What do you think
soon.
About it?
Here's what I'm telling him. Here's where I think he's coming from, because, you know, I've talked about it, is that this is a business person who's running the government, and he doesn't understand why this is such a political vote. He's looking for a way to depoliticize the debt ceiling so that it's not used as sort of this end of
cudgel.
The world. Exactly. It's a lever, but it's also brinksmanship that he's not comfortable with using. He's trying to figure out a way to sort of neuter that. I don't know if he's just against the debt ceiling, and I'm honestly giving you an answer. I don't know if he's just against the debt ceiling as a concept, or he's against it being sort of misused to give leverage over a president or to a
particular
party.
Before I hand the ball off to Steve Chigueras, you, when you were a member of the House, successfully used the pressure cooker of a vote on the debt ceiling to extract serious spending reductions.
Every chance I got.
Right.
Yes.
Do you want to give that up? Or do you want to give that up on behalf of other like-minded Republicans?
Again, the president's asked me to look at it. We're going to look at it. There could be benefits to doing it. There could be disadvantages to doing it. You could be, one of the things I've not thought through yet is the president actually giving up authority by giving up a debt ceiling? Keep in mind, he has to sign it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a certain leverage that the president can bring to the discussion as well. So
You sound ambivalent.
Yeah, I am ambivalent about it right now. So we're going to look at it and continue to look at it. My guess is we'll take it up again in December.
Steve Chigueras.
Some of your former colleagues, Republican colleagues in the House, look at you and say, this is not necessarily the perfect fit for you in the White House. I want to just go back to May 10th, 2016, when you said to the Post and Courier newspaper, this is after you voted for Marco Rubio in the primary, and this is after the president clinched the nomination.
So this is May of
2016.
Okay.
You said, "I'm more than happy to support Donald Trump for president and support the Republican nominee. My confidence level in him as a conservative doing the right thing can be low at times. My confidence in Hillary Clinton doing the wrong thing is high at all the time." So your confidence in the president right now being a conservative, where is that?
Look, I'll be perfectly candid with you. I don't think it's any surprise or secret this. I'm one of the more conservative people in the White House. There's no doubt about that. The president and I are going to disagree from time to time on things. Let's take the highest profile example, I think, up to now has been my view on entitlement reform on Social Security and Medicare. And I've talked at length about how I made my pitch to the president.
Reenact that for us, if
sure.
You would.
I believe that you have to make changes to those programs. And I went in during the budget process and sat across the oval resolute desk from him and said, "Mr. President, here's mandatory entitlement reforms I'd like to see in the budget. And this is this and this, this, this." And he looked down and he goes, "Yes to that one, yes to that one, no to those three, yes to that one, and no to that one." And the no's were all Social Security and Medicare. Because he said, "Look,
flat nose.
I promised people when I ran that I wouldn't change that. I'm not going to change that. Period. End of story." Does that mean I'm not comfortable in the job? Absolutely not. I'm comfortable taking the conservative, right wing, if you will, position in that White House. Because if I don't, no one else might. And if I can simply get in front of the president and make those arguments, I think I inform his decision and it'll be a better decision. I'll lose a lot. That's fine. As I joke with my friends back on the Hill, I said, "Mulvaney, it sounds like you're losing a lot." I said, "Yes, but I'm losing at the very highest level." Whereas they're losing in the basement of the Tortilla Coast.
So one of your former colleagues, Jeff Duncan.
Which is not an actual coastline. It's a restaurant.
We should probably hit the Tortilla Coast one of these days.
We will. I guarantee you. Tortilla Coast will host this podcast. And we will be delighted to be there.
As a former owner of a chain of Mexican, or part owner of a chain of Mexican restaurants, and one who operated one myself, I have actually rolled the burritos and fried the chips. The best nacho chips I've ever had.
Really?
Tortilla Coast.
Okay, we're going to Tortilla Coast.
All right, good.
I want to say one thing. Your fellow congressman, former congressman Jeff Duncan of South Carolina told Politico just a couple weeks ago, "It's got to be tough to carry water for a president who doesn't believe what Mick believes." Is it tough to carry water for him?
When I took the job, I remember very vividly, he offered me the job and I had a chance to talk to Steve Bannon about it. And I had not met Steve up until that point. I knew who he was, obviously, but I had not talked to him. I said, "Look, Steve, I'm not going to agree with this president on everything. If he's looking for a yes man, I'm not the right person for the job." And Bannon said, "Far from it. The president not only welcomes dissent, he's actively encouraging it. He wants you because you are going to provide a different perspective on things." And that's what I've done for the last 8 months.
And how's that working out for you? Because we've heard stories about the president not enjoying people who butt heads with him.
I have a tremendous relationship with the president. Was doing it just this morning in the Oval Office on the topic of infrastructure. Wasn't butting heads.
He digs you because you're good on the Sunday shows, right?
I'm a big believer in having it
that
out
counts, right?
Inside the family. Okay, where I can present my side of things, Gary Cohn gives, Mnuchin gives his, somebody else, Bannon gives his, and then we agree and the president decides. The president says, "This is the policy of the administration." And the fact that I've been able to participate in that process makes me very comfortable to go out and say, "Look, this is not exactly what I would have done if I'm the president, but I'm not the president, and I can back this president on this policy 100%. And I think he appreciates that.
You just said Steve Bannon. Trump White House, stronger or weaker that Steve Bannon is no longer there?
I think in terms of policy, I will miss Steve a lot. I liked having other conservatives around there. There's still a good many conservatives in the West Wing. There's no question about it. I think from a procedural standpoint, if I look, I won't speak to just Steve's departure, but when I look at the changes that the president has made in the last 4 or 5 weeks in a couple different personnel positions, we run as a really well-oiled machine right now in ways that we didn't do before. And I'm very happy. The meetings with the president are better. The focus on substance is better. John Kelly is probably the best hire I think the president has made at any cabinet level. He's doing a tremendous job. So I won't say it's because Steve's departure. I've said because of Kelly's addition, things are running much better.
And what does that mean in relationship to the way Reince Priebus did that job as chief of staff?
I just think it was a different personality. I think Reince was a lot more collaborative guy, was more of an open door policy, and maybe
more deferential.
A little bit more. And I think the president charged Kelly with actually changing things, and he's been able to do it. And he's got the stature necessary to do it. He's been an excellent, excellent chief of staff.
So there are choke points to get into the Oval Office now, and there are phone conversations that Kelly's on that the previous chief of staff wasn't on. I mean, there is it feels like a much more intense discipline to all conversations and everything that flows toward the president's desk.
But that's the way it's got to work. Keep in mind, if it doesn't work like that, here's what happens. Okay, I have a meeting with the president on topic A, a budget topic. And maybe someone else then comes in after me when I'm not there, no one else is there, and says to the president, oh, by the way, the decision you just made with Mulvaney is wrong. Here's why. And the president might then have that piece of information.
That stuff happened.
And then I would have to come back in.
That happened.
Yeah. Now we have everybody in the room at one time, once, and we make decisions. And it really, again, I think you just start to see much better product out of the White House.
That's Mick Mulvaney, the director of the Office of Management and Budget. And we're going to get to a little bit of the other part of that job. There's budget and management regulations in a second. We are joined, as we are every week, by Steve Shigaris, political director of CBS, the world's greatest podcast sidekick. We are at the Tombs Restaurant in Georgetown, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to The Takeout.
Welcome back. I'm going to play to the cameras for just a second. I haven't been doing that at all. Hello, camera, CBSN audience. We love you so much. You know, on this podcast, we have the Takeout podcast sticker signed by me, Major Garrett, your esteemed and super qualified host. There is only one way, OMB Director Mick Mulvaney, anyone in our audience can obtain one of these signed Takeout podcast stickers. They can't send us a Twitter.
Okay.
A tweet. They can't send us a Facebook post. They can't send us an email. There's only one way, and one way only.
Smoke signals.
How do they do it, Steve Shigaris?
Well, if you'd like your very own Takeout podcast sticker signed by Major Garrett, send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope.
Self-addressed stamped envelope.
To Takeout sticker, care of CBS News at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036.
And because by occupation, the OMB director is a statistics person, Steve, share with him the statistics on those who have requested said sticker.
So we maintain a Google spreadsheet.
We do.
I'm sure you probably do.
State yes. by state. We have no other job.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So state by state. So
nice.
I just want to let you know, Mr. Mulvaney, that you need to talk to your friends in South Carolina, because of the 302 letters we've received.
302 letters. That's a letter with a self-addressed stamped envelope.
We call that
envelope.
A SAZY.
Yeah.
You know how many came from South Carolina?
Probably none.
One.
Not good enough.
I was close.
Let's get your folks on that, will you?
And the food has arrived. BLT, yes. Looking very, very nice. Shigaris, your fish and chips looking very fishy and chippy. Katiana, if you'd be so kind, play for the OMB director, Mick Mulvaney, maybe one of the favorite sound bites he's ever heard in his whole life. Number four.
I took some time out to sit down with my staff, and we began going through the budget that you're presenting today. And after about 5 minutes, I said, this is a total waste of time. I don't want to do this anymore. And the reason it's a waste of time is I think you know that the budget that's been presented is not going to be the budget we're going to deal with. Just not.
That is the voice of Bob Corker, Tennessee Republican Senator, Chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. That's his reaction. I think it would be fair to describe it as candid to the budget submitted before his and other members of Congress.
Jeez,
and
I honestly
the Senate.
Don't remember that.
And
one.
He said but, that yeah. right to Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, who was testifying.
Oh, good.
Testifying
yeah.
about
it wasn't to
next
you.
Year's
oh,
budget
wow,
request,
but it was about the sharp reduction in future spending for the State Department.
Gotcha.
Some 33%?
Yeah, 31%.
31%.
It's been a couple months.
But who's counting?
He I am. Actually,
I am.
Actually, the answer to that is yes. He is.
And Rex.
So, that's an ally, at least in theory, saying this document doesn't even warrant 10 minutes of inspection, let alone 5. How do you react to that?
I had a call from Senator Pat Leahy. Democrat, I think he's ranking member.
From Vermont,
yes. Really nice guy. He called me. I called everybody the day the budget came out. And just it's sort of the protocol you do. You call the majority leader, you call minority leaders, you call the ranking members and the chairman and so forth. And he said, well, son, I've been here 40-some years.
Wait a minute. He said son?
Oh, yeah. Well, the guy's like 140 years old. He said, I've been here for whatever it was, 44 years, and I just want to let you know the good news is your budget is no more dead on arrival mm-hmm. than every other presidential budget I've seen since I've got here. So thanks very much. And that was the end of the conversation. The president's budget is a messaging document. It's meant to to convey the priorities of the administration.
It's an attitude.
Yeah, and we didn't want to spend a lot of money on overseas aid. That's what the president ran on. That shouldn't come as a surprise. It probably doesn't come as a surprise to Senator Corker, who I like, by the way, and I don't take any of those comments personally. The president ran saying, we're going to spend less money overseas. And when you say, I'm going to spend less money overseas, then the State Department budget goes down. In fact, when I unveiled the budget, I told folks how we did it. We went back to his speeches and picked out lines from his speeches. And if he said stuff, I like this program, they got more money. I don't like this program, they got less money. I'm going to spend more money over here, that spending went up. Spend less money overseas, that spending went down. So it was simply a manifestation of the president's campaign put to numbers.
So you spent a lot of time, probably a lot of sleepless nights, putting together a document that was basically pro forma, it sounds like. I got another quote here from a Democratic member of Congress who told me and other reporters last week that you and the White House are irrelevant, not someone appropriators listen to on the Hill. I don't even hear Mulvaney's name come up, he said, and I don't feel like the White House is terribly relevant in terms of appropriations discussions. What's your reaction to that?
I thought Gowdy was a Republican.
No, so I'm chewing my food.
Hold on. That's an inside joke, folks. Yep.
Congressman Trey Gowdy,
right.
Republican of South Carolina, good friend of yours.
Yep. Thanks, Shigaris.
Sorry, yeah. I didn't realize you had a mouthful of Juicy Lucy over here.
What do you expect them to say? They're the Democrats. What do they say, nice things about my budget? Come on now. I mean, that's to be expected.
But how do you
right?
feel about putting together a document that basically...
Hold on. Because, yes, it's a Democrat, but it's also an appropriator. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I learned after spending about 15 to 20 years covering the United States Congress... There are Republicans, there are Democrats, and there are appropriators.
You got that 100% right.
And so they're the party of their own.
Yeah, they are. And that's fine. And they're going to write the. They're good.
And by that I mean their inclination is to protect the discretionary side of the budget, which is the day to day, year to year functions of the federal government.
But protect and also their constitutional right of. Holding the purse.
They got the power of the purse. I get that. But here's my point to you about, and I don't know who it was, and I don't need to know who it was, but if that person, the Democrat appropriator, was being entirely honest and candid with you, probably said the exact same thing about all eight Obama budgets. Mm. They didn't care about that budget either. They were going to write what they were going to write. That's just the nature of being in the appropriator party. And the president's budget is a nice pro forma, to use your word, in their minds. That's what it is. But they're going to write what they want to write. And that's part of the negotiation, which is where we're going to be in December.
It begs the question for our audience, what's the point? If you're going to put together a budget from the White House, what's the point in doing it?
It's a couple things. It's required by law. The Budget Act of 1974 mm-hmm. requires the president to provide to submit a budget to Congress. But beyond that, the value is on sending the message. Now, when you get a little bit down deeper into it, the point I would make to the appropriator is that the appropriators actually took about $5 billion worth of our proposed cuts. Yeah, we proposed $54 billion, but I actually just got a list, late last week, of what is going to go into this appropriations package that they're working on this week that actually started
in the House
in our budget. Right. So the House will vote on stuff this week that actually contains pieces and parts of our budget. Might they have gotten there by themselves? Maybe. They also maybe appreciate the cover knowing that they reduced spending on a program. The president's got their back because he had it in that particular budget. Yeah, that could work as well. So, listen, I know the game. I know the dance. And that's how Washington works. None of it – I don't take any of it personally. I don't think they mean it personally. This is how Washington works.
This podcast is obviously well-watched and well-listened to in Washington, but it's also a phenomenon across the country. And our country is gripped right now by – natural disasters in three, actually, very important states, Texas, Louisiana, and Florida. And I went into great detail a couple of episodes ago wishing the best to Texas and Louisiana. And this podcast wishes all the best to the people of Florida, north and south. Every part of that state at one level or another is dealing with the after effects of Hurricane Irma. One of the things that's going to be incumbent upon this administration and this Congress is to provide not just rescue funds and relief funds, but ongoing reconstruction funds in the aftermath of both of those. This is a multi-billion dollar proposition. Superstorm Sandy registered $60 billion at the federal level. Katrina was, I believe, more than $100 billion, possibly $200 billion. Do you have any back of the envelope sense at all, Director Mulvaney, what was going to be required and what kind of things this federal government is going to have to do to those who were affected by either one of these storms who are outside of the floodplain, who are not participants in the National Flood Insurance Program, but who need some means by which to get back on their feet.
The only number that I've seen come out of Texas so far was a number that I think the Governor Abbott put on, saying he expected the damage may be someplace between $120 and $140 billion. Now we'll stop for a second and realize what a huge range that is, because $20 billion is $20,000 million. It's a wide range. But I think if you drill down into the details, what you see is that may be the total damage. Then you have to go in and figure out, okay, what was covered by insurance, what can be made up by current federal programs and so forth. There's a couple bottom lines to take away from Harvey, from Irma, in terms of the federal response. First of all, we've pulled out all the stops in making sure that we deal with the emergent situation, the emergency situation, dealing with search and rescue, dealing with debris removal like we are today in Florida, still dealing with it over in Texas, dealing with security, safety on the ground. In fact, the president took the extraordinary step of taking 100% federal responsibility for 30 days for the safety and security. So that's never been done before, I don't think.
For Irma.
Yeah, for Irma and for Harvey.
Harvey, okay.
Yeah, so I don't think that's ever been done before. It may have been done as part of Katrina, but that may have been well after the fact. So we're dealing first things first, making sure people are safe, making sure people got out of the way of the hurricane. And then what will happen is we'll move into the next phase, which is what was the real damage, okay? Which did your house have 2 feet of water in it? Did it have 8 feet of water? Because there's a difference there. What utilities are gone in your house? Did you have flood insurance? We are going to continue to work with the states to make sure that folks have what they need. Now, that said, I think one of the first things that the FEMA director said on the day of the day after Harvey was that we're not going to be able to make everybody whole. You just can't. And importantly, you asked a serious question. I'll give you a serious answer. I have to ask, if you were responsible enough and bought flood insurance, should you be treated the same as somebody who didn't?
But what if you're not in the floodplain?
And
many people in Harris County, Texas,
and I get that, because we had this exact thing come up in South Carolina 2 years ago, I think, when I was in Congress. We had 35 inches of rain in a weekend. Very serious thing. I've seen it, and we flooded outside of a flood zone. I get all that. And there are FEMA programs that provide for help for that. I think it's up to $30,000, which doesn't sound like much, but keep in mind, many houses, not all, but many houses are repairable. If you had 2 feet of water in your house, you have to go and you have to rip out the carpeting, you have to rip out the subfloor, you have to rip out the sheetrock and so forth. But it doesn't typically totally damage the house to the point you have to raise it to the foundations and start again. So it's going to be
$30,000 can make a difference.
It can make a lot of difference. Right. And so there's a lot of federal programs. We'll continue to work. I think the president has sent a very clear message early on that we are helping people. That will continue. It's way too early to start to say, okay, this program will be in effect. We'll have to do new programs. This is the amount of money. We're dealing with it day by day, and I think that's the appropriate response.
So let me ask you before we go. National Flood Insurance Program, it is $24.5 billion in debt?
Something like that.
Many critics and even the Obama administration said we need to rethink this whole process about subsidizing the development and positioning of people, businesses, infrastructure in places that are prone to flood damage. As a matter of policy, where does the Office of Management and Budget come down on that? And do you want Congress to seriously and structurally rethink national flood insurance, and if so, in what direction?
I do, and this is one of those places where this has not made it to the president's desk yet, so what you're hearing is what I'll be presenting or advocating to the president, which is part of my job, and there'll be other folks in the White House giving either the similar or different opinions on things. I think it's silly that we've paid to repair the same houses 4 and 5 times. I just think that doesn't make sense. I don't think it makes sense that we
which is one of the reasons the National Flood Insurance Program is in debt.
That's exactly right. That we do not have a market-based system. By the way, this is, well, invariably the news will show impact on folks on the lower end of the economic scale. Really, if you're honest with yourself, the flood insurance program is a subsidy to folks who actually are on the higher end of the economic scale, folks who can afford to build a house right on the coast.
And maybe not to be subsidized.
That's exactly right. So these are really hard questions to ask, but they have to be.
And they're very political ones.
They are, but we're going to do it. We're going to take a look at it, and we'll make the case for the president for try and fix the system when we get the chance.
As we wrap up and head to our Tuesday Takeout Outtake Especial, I just want to say this. Mick Mulvaney, courage. Eat on camera. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's how it's done.
Could you
eat
hear it or not?
On camera.
You couldn't hear it?
No, that was great.
Didn't hear it, but you did it anyway.
I'm really
that
hungry.
Noisy Harris that was never eats on camera.
I just had a bite of a fry.
Never so eats on camera.
So we did it here one time with another network, and they filmed it down in the other part of the Tombs.
Yeah,
and,
whatever.
And we had beer. And the deal was that I would
not
drink,
beer,
I would drink the beer during the interview, but they couldn't actually show me drinking the beer. So what they had sort of stop action on what my beer looked like between the different sections of the. I will drink a pint of Guinness every night.
We'll buy you a beer anytime you want, Mr.
Not,
Director.
Not at noon, maybe.
So the next cabinet meeting, what I want you to do when it starts, after the president does his opening remarks, say, yeah. "Hey, I was just on this phenomenal show. All of you need to get on that show. It's called The Takeout." Mick Mulvaney, Office of Management and Budget. Thanks.
Thanks, y'all.
You've been listening to. And enjoying and watching Shigeru's Never Eats.
The Takeout.
Thank you.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Fari, Katiana Kachenko, and CBS News Radio. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. And for more, visit takeoutpodcast.com.
All right, so I'm going to lob you a softball. So how do you measure yourself against other golfers?
By height? I don't. Thank
you very much. Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much.
By height.
Come on.
By height. That's right.
By height.